You're listening to ABC Radio Australia's podcast of Pacific Beat. You can also get the latest news and analysis from the region online. Just search ABC Radio Australia and Pacific Beat, or follow ABC Radio Australia on Facebook.
Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Jordan Fennell. Very happy to be with you here on this Wednesday morning. Coming up on the show this hour, concerns that the arrest of a West Papuan independence campaigner, Victor Wamo, could lead to more violence in the region. Coming up a bit later on, in about 15 minutes, I'll be joined by Vanuatu's opposition leader, Ralph Reganvanu, who will join me to discuss his thoughts on the issue. Also coming up, Rugby League Samoa could be getting some fresh coaching blood in the form of NRL greats Matty and Andrew Johns and Sonny Bill Williams. You'll get an update on this coming up in about 20 minutes. But first, to Fiji, where the COVID-19 outbreak continues.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Fiji has recorded another 12 COVID-19 cases, which is one of the largest daily increases since its second wave began last month. But the government has stopped short of ordering a complete lockdown. All of the new cases are linked to a woman who tested positive to the virus on Monday, and they all live on the outskirts of the capital, Suva. Fiji's top public health official, Dr. James Fong, says while they're all in isolation, they believe there are more positive cases out in the community.
We know that since a large number of these persons' close contacts have now tested positive, that means that there has been a significant amount of movement and potential for transmission of the virus to others. Let's remember this cluster began with another case of unknown origin. So that means there could still be a contagious case or cases among the public we have yet to identify that will still pose a threat to all of us every time we make a decision to leave our home. Home is where you are safest.
Dr. James Fong and his public health team briefed the country's Prime Minister and Health Minister yesterday, but they've chosen not to order any further lockdowns in coming days. But Dr. Fong says the rising cases and clusters has prompted him to develop various scenarios that include a possible lockdown of the main island Viti Levu, which is home to the country's largest population centres like Suva and Nandi.
In the event our priority is locking down the virus in an active fashion, as I've said yesterday, for that lockdown to be decisive, it must be well planned and prolonged enough to last for the entire incubation period and more. The goal of the lockdown is to stop all unnecessary movement and mixing between different people, informal gatherings and other high-risk activities that will carry significant penalties. Essential movement will have to be highly controlled. Businesses and private sector must take on a much higher level of responsibility if they expect to operate at all. And I want to assure the public that if we take the lockdown route, they will be given ample notice, not hours, but days, to prepare.
But panic about a possible lockdown and the spread of the virus is already growing. People lined up outside supermarkets yesterday, and social media was rife with rumours of a lockdown already being introduced. Rani Heyman has been speaking to Professor Fiona Russell, an Australian epidemiologist who has lived and worked in Fiji. And she says that while thousands of people are already virtually under lockdown anyway, stricter measures would be an effective way to stop the virus spreading any further.
We know what works against combating COVID. One is the non-pharmaceutical intervention. So we know that if people don't move, then the virus doesn't move. So that's extremely effective. We know, and that's what the Fiji government is doing at the moment. And so that's a very effective thing. And secondly, it's the vaccination program. And so the government is very much in the hands of the international community in terms of how much vaccine gets rolled out there in a timely manner. But the government is doing everything they can to prevent the infection, and very successfully up until now.
How do you think things will play out if a lockdown is announced?
You know, Fiji in particular, I mean, they've got the army, they've got the police, they're extremely good at doing roadblocks and stopping people move, and you know, a very compliant population by and large from what we can see. So that's the most critical thing, what will happen over the next couple of weeks or, you know, this week and next week as to what will happen and in terms of easing restrictions or not, or seeing the extent of community transmission. So that's extremely important.
Professor Fiona Russell, an epidemiologist and the Asia Pacific Health Group leader at the Murdoch Children's Research Institute. And she was speaking there to Rani Heyman.
Pacific Beat.
Now, the strain of the COVID-19 virus at the centre of Fiji's current outbreak is said to be the Indian variant B1617. The World Health Organization has warned that that particular strain should be labelled a variant of concern, along with other highly contagious strains out of Brazil, South Africa and the UK. The overall death toll from coronavirus in India is approaching almost a quarter of a million people. And as Gavin Coote reports, Prime Minister Narendra Modi is under increasing pressure to order a national lockdown.
The images of burning funeral pyres and overloaded crematoriums have become the tragic emblems of India's second COVID wave. About 4,000 people are dying of the virus in India each day, and many experts fear the actual numbers are far greater. Kuma is among the crematorium workers in the southern Indian city of Bangalore.
I cremate about 50 bodies of COVID-19 victims in a day. I come here at 7 in the morning, and I stay here until 10 o'clock at night.
As many of India's crematoriums run out of space, makeshift facilities are becoming increasingly common. But on the banks of the Ganges River in the country's north, things have taken yet another grim turn. The bodies of at least 40 people have washed up along the river, which local media reports suggest could be COVID-19 victims. India's situation is dire, and it's one that the World Health Organization is warning poses a global health risk. The WHO has now designated the COVID-19 variant first found in India one of global concern. Its technical lead for COVID-19 is Maria Van Kerkhove.
In consultation with our virus evolution working group and our epi teams and our lab teams internally, there is some available information to suggest increased transmissibility of B1617. There is a preprint that is out. So this is a paper that has not undergone peer review, and it's of a limited number of patients suggesting that there is some reduced neutralization. And as such, we are classifying this as a variant of concern at the global level.
By declaring it a variant of concern, the WHO is acknowledging growing evidence which finds the mutation of the virus in India could be spread more quickly than the original strain. It's only classified three others to be of global concern, those found in Britain, South Africa and Brazil. As India's coronavirus infections hover around daily record highs, calls have been growing for a nationwide lockdown, including from leading figures outside of India. The US's top COVID advisor, Anthony Fauci, says he's advised Indian authorities that it's the only way to arrest the surge in cases, telling the American ABC network the current lockdowns affecting some cities and states isn't enough.
So there's an immediate problem, which is hospital beds, oxygen, PPE and other supplies. And then there's the problem looking forward of how you're going to shut this down, how you're going to turn it around, how you're going to break the chain of transmission. Vaccines is one of them, but there are other ways too, like shutting down the government. I have advised them in the past that you really need to do that. You've got to shut down. I believe several of the Indian states have already done that, but you need to break the chain of transmission. And one of the ways to do that is to shut down.
Any national shutdown will have come too late for some neighbouring countries like Nepal, where its healthcare system is also under major pressure. The founder of the Australian International Development Network, Simon Lewis, warns there's a desperate need for financial support.
The situation in Nepal is obviously escalating, and I think this kind of gets to coronavirus and reminds us that issues like coronavirus require us to take, it's a response that's going to be needed in this sort of subcontinent.
The World Health Organization has launched a fundraising appeal to buy oxygen and medical equipment in India and is again pressing the need to get all countries vaccinated.
Gavin Coote reporting there.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on on ABC Radio Australia.
That's right. You're with me, Jordan Fennell, here on the ABC's Pacific Beat here on Radio Australia. And still to come on the show this hour, I'll be joined by Ralph Reganvanu, Vanuatu's opposition leader, who's also an advocate for West Papuan independence. I'll be chatting with him about the recent arrest of independence campaigner Victor Wamo and the concerns about potential escalated violence in the region. But before that, I do have some music out of West Papua. This is from a band called Mumbesak. It is a West Papuan folk-based musical group that was formed in 1978, and this is their song Munam Mingil. Bit of West Papuan folk music for you on your Wednesday morning. That was the band Mumbesak with Munam Mingil.
Pacific Beat.
Now, the arrest of an independence campaigner on treason charges is raising concerns that West Papua is on a path to more violence, with hundreds of troops deployed to the disputed Indonesian province. Tension has been high after a high-ranking military leader was killed during a shootout with a pro-independence group last month. Now, Victor Wamo has been detained over his role in organising anti-racism protests 2 years ago. But Benny Wender, the chairman of the United Liberation Movement for West Papua, is worried Mr. Wamo's arrest will only lead to further unrest.
Internet cut off almost in Jayapura, in Wamena, and all last 4 days. So this is clear that Indonesia hiding something. I'm calling the media to allow international media allow to West Papua, Oxfam and Red Cross to allow West Papua into West Papua, and international intervention needed.
The Indonesian government has announced a military crackdown and declared all armed groups to be terrorists, including non-violent pro-independence groups. Now, Ralph Reganvanu is Vanuatu's opposition leader and a staunch advocate for West Papua's independence, and he joins me now on the line from Port Vila. Good morning, Mr. Reganvanu.
Good morning.
How concerned are you right now about this increased tension in West Papua?
Well, it's very concerning. We've seen the steady ramping up of the military occupation of West Papua over the last few years. Hundreds or thousands more troops coming into the territory. We've seen footage of helicopter gunships strafing the highland villages. Now we've just seen an internet blackout so that news can't be shared on social media, which is one of the main ways we get news out of West Papua, because international media is banned from the whole territory. This violence has been going on for many, many years, 50 years or so, but now it's getting to a new stage with the declaration by the Indonesian authorities that, you know, the rebels are a terrorist group. That designation is very worrying because it normally allows states to then use maximum violence and force and kill people like that. So we've had some statements also from, for example, the chairman of the People's Consultative Assembly of Indonesia, which is like their parliament. And he's quoted as saying, destroy them first, we will discuss human rights matters later. And so with that kind of attitude from the Indonesian government, in the face of widespread condemnation of the human rights abuses that are going on, in the face of 80 states around the world asking for the UN Human Rights Commissioner for Human Rights to pay a visit and do an independent assessment of the human rights situation there, and that request being blocked for 2 years now, almost 2 years now. It seems like something is going on that is going to be a tragedy, a continuing of the genocide that's been going on for many years.
You mentioned there the calls for the UN Human Rights Commissioner to visit West Papua, and as you said, 2 years on, that call hasn't progressed and the UN hasn't visited. Should Pacific Island countries, through the Pacific Islands Forum or the Melanesian Spearhead Group, do more to raise awareness about this issue?
Absolutely. It was the Pacific Island Forum leaders, in fact, at their last leaders' summit, which was 2 years ago in Tuvalu, who actually passed the resolution asking for the UN Human Rights Commissioner for Human Rights to visit, and actually they welcomed the invitation by Indonesia for this visit to take place. So, in fact, the invitation was put out by Indonesia. The Pacific Island Forum leaders welcomed that and asked it for it to go ahead and asked for that report, which would be an evidence-based, informed report on the situation of the human rights in West Papua, to be presented to the Pacific leaders at the forum meeting that was supposed to be held last year in August in Vanuatu, which obviously wasn't held because of the COVID-19 pandemic. But now we're, of course, almost 12 months after that date that was set by the Pacific Island Forum leaders, and nothing's happened. So, yes, the Pacific Island Forum countries who made the call should be putting pressure on Indonesia, on the world community, the United Nations, to implement what was agreed upon. And also, we've got to remember that the African Caribbean Pacific Group, the ACP, which is made up of about 76 states, including Africa, Caribbean, and the Pacific, also reaffirmed that resolution. So this is basically half the world calling upon Indonesia to allow the UN Human Rights Commissioner for Human Rights to visit, to make an assessment, and that request has not been granted. So it's up to the world community, and especially the leaders, to ramp up the pressure to make sure that we do get, you know, international media, the UN Human Rights Commissioner, all human rights groups in there to make that assessment, because what we're getting now is two different sides of the story, and we need an independent assessment to actually be able to address what's going on. But we do know that massive human rights violations are happening.
And Mr. Reganvanu, you're quoted in the Vanuatu Daily Post as saying that Vanuatu needs to support West Papua by ensuring that the United Liberation Movement of West Papua's application for full membership in the Melanesian Spearhead Group goes ahead and is listed on the agenda for the MSG leaders' meeting. Have you had any further discussions with the Vanuatu government or within your own party about this?
Yes, I've talked to the Prime Minister. And the Prime Minister of Vanuatu intends to do exactly that, make sure it is listed on the agenda, and will push for full membership. You've got to remember that the Melanesian Spearhead Group was set up especially to assist the decolonization of the remaining colonies in Melanesia, more specifically for New Caledonia, which is now well on its way to decolonization. It's had its referendums, it's part of a process that's internationally supervised, which is, so we can say that that process has now been achieved, it's happening. But for West Papua, we're seeing the situation getting worse. And the ULMWP does have observer status in the MSG. Indonesia has associate membership. And this is the only forum where both the Indonesian government and the United Liberation Movement of West Papua, which is recognized as the official representative of the people of West Papua asking for self-determination, are already in the same body. So we're calling on, Vanuatu is calling on the other Melanesian states to elevate the status of ULMWP at the next leaders' meeting. The application has been submitted some years ago. It's now at the stage where it will be considered and decided upon by the leaders at the next MSG meeting. We need to provide ULMWP with the same status or full membership of the MSG so that it can be at the same table, talking directly with Indonesia, with support from the other Melanesian states. We need peaceful dialogue. We need dialogue between Indonesia and West Papua to find a way forward. And this is the forum that they are, both parties are already in, and we can try and use it.
You're listening to Vanuatu politician Ralph Regan Vanu, and I'm chatting with him about developments in West Papua at the moment. Mr. Regan Vanu, you were saying there that the MSG, Melanesian Spearhead Group, is a forum potentially for peaceful dialogue between Indonesia and the West Papuan provinces. Do you think there's common ground for the independence movement and Indonesia? And if so, what will it take to get there to really hash it out and discuss these things?
It's difficult to imagine that there is common ground, given the position of the Indonesian government, which seems to be hardening on this issue. But we have to try. And failing Indonesia, sitting down in good faith to have these discussions, the international community continue to put on the pressure, has to ramp up the pressure to force Indonesia to deal with the situation. Remember that Myanmar just happened, and the president of Indonesia was instrumental in coming up within ASEAN countries with a consensus strategy for Myanmar, which was all about releasing political prisoners, ending military violence, dialogue, allowing humanitarian access. And this was, in fact, announced by President Jokowi. And so this is the same approach we want to see happening in West Papua. If Indonesia can advocate for that process to happen in Myanmar, then they should also apply the same process in West Papua.
Ralph Regan Vanu, thank you very much for joining me here on Pacific Beat this morning.
Thank you.
That was Ralph Regan Vanu, Vanuatu's opposition leader, also a staunch advocate for West Papua's independence, speaking with me there.
ABC Radio Australia.
Hi, I'm Hilda Wayne. I'll be hosting a new show on ABC Radio Australia, Sisters, Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women. So join me, Hilda Wayne, for Sisters, Let's Talk. Starts Friday, the 14th of May at 3:30 p.m. PNT time
on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, it's time now to get a look at the news-making headlines across the region, and I'm joined by Richard Hewitt. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Jordan.
Richard, let's start with more news on the COVID-19 situation in the Pacific, because more vaccine supplies are set to be delivered to Solomon Islands.
Yeah, it's beginning to look like, well, let's call it vaccine wars in the Solomons, because after it was confirmed that 50,000 doses of the new WHO-approved Chinese-manufactured Sinopharm were already in the country, Australia has, to use a poker term, seen China's 50,000 and raise it to 60,000 with the offer to deliver that number of doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine at the rate of 10,000 a week. The Solomons are one of four countries in the region, along with Fiji, PNG and Timor-Leste, that have been prioritised to receive supplies of that vaccine, which will be produced here in Melbourne. Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare has accepted the Australian offer, and he says the National Drugs, Medicine and Therapeutic Committee will be meeting soon to consider approval and a distribution plan. Meanwhile, in Nauru, here's one for the statisticians. The COVID-19 vaccination campaign has exceeded government expectations, so much so that an official statement talks of 7,392 having received a first dose, or according to that same statement, that's 108% of the adult population.
It's pretty impressive.
A curiosity, to say the least, but I can explain. The official number of people in Nauru based on the last census is smaller than 7,392 in terms of the adults that they were going to give vaccine to. So hence the actual figure is at more than 100%. It's weird. And I don't know why they put it in a statement, but they did.
Hey, but happy for them that they're able to have done that, 108%.
Well, if we could do that worldwide, we'd be very happy.
Exactly.
Wouldn't we?
Better than some other countries. Now, Richard, turning to some sports news, because there's news breaking on the rugby front in New Zealand, and it's good news for the Pacific.
OneNews has told its viewers in New Zealand that New Zealand rugby are in discussions over playing a test match against Tonga, with Mount Smart and Waikato stadiums in the mix to host the game. And there's more, with a potential clash between Manu Samoa and the Maori All Blacks on the cards for the same date. That's July the 3rd. The All Blacks will also be playing back-to-back tests against the Flying Fijians on July 10th and 17th, with venues to be confirmed. Now, New Zealand have never played back-to-back tests against any Pacific Island team before, and in the last 4 years, Tonga is actually the only Pacific side that they've played previously. So why is this all happening now? Well, the sudden interest in playing Pacific teams from New Zealand, I reckon, is all down to COVID-19. With Italy calling off their proposed tour, the New Zealand authorities for once decided to look in their own backyard for some opposition. It would be nice to think that more of these matches will be played in the post-COVID world, but watch this space. As a postscript, I should mention the two-leg World Cup playoff between Tonga and Samoa. They were meant to play one match in Apia, one in Nuku'alofa. Both matches will now be played in New Zealand again because of the COVID-19 travel situation. Also in July, Manusina Samoa will be playing Australia's women's team, the Wallaroos, in Brisbane as part of a doubleheader that will also feature the Wallabies up against France, unless, of course, the French don't make the trip, in which case maybe there could be another opportunity for a Pacific team. We'll see.
Yeah, lots happening in rugby world. I'm sure rugby fans very excited that this is all kicking off still and moving ahead after 2020, of course, put a lot of sport on the sidelines. Staying on sports news, though, there's three of our rugby sevens teams now know what they have to do to make it to the Tokyo Olympics, apparently.
They do, and it's going to be tough. The repechage that will decide which men's and which women's team will get the last two Olympic places in Japan, that will be played in Monaco, so that's hard enough. They've got to get there first. In the men's event, Samoa and Tonga will line up in the same pool with Ireland, Zimbabwe and Mexico. And the top two will go into the semi-finals. So if Samoa finishes first and Tonga finishes second, or vice versa, they would avoid each other in the semi-finals. So in an ideal world, they'll be in an all-Pacific final and we'd be guaranteed a Pacific men's team to go to the Olympics. That will be perfect. In the women's event, Papua New Guinea are our only representatives, and they are the top-ranked team, though, in a pool with Kazakhstan, Jamaica and Tunisia. So on paper, PNG should make the semis, but with the likes of Russia, France and Argentina in other pools, well, really a place at the Olympics with a Pacific team would be a huge achievement. But if they did it, course for national celebration,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, it would be amazing. One to keep our eye on there. And also, still to come on the show this hour, we do have more sports news, Richard, coming up, because, of course, there potentially could be some fresh coaching blood in the National Rugby Samoa League there, with big names potentially joining. So we'll have that coming up later on the show. But
we
Richard,
will.
Thank you very much.
The Johns brothers and Sonny Bill could
exactly
be on their way. A lot of speculation.
Very interesting, very interesting. That's still to come here on Pacific Beat. Now time for a quick weather update from the capital cities across the region. In Port Moresby, it will be cloudy today with some patchy rain and an expected top of 31 degrees. In Honiara, also rainy today, and thunderstorms are expected and a high of 30 degrees. Over in Nuku'alofa, partly cloudy and a little bit cooler with a top of 27 degrees. In Port Vila, you're also expecting a top of 27 degrees and you'll have brief showers across the day. In Suva, a strong wind warning does remain in place across the country, and you're expecting a cloudy day with some showers and a top of 28 degrees. And finally, in Apia, cloudy and rainy today with a top of 30 degrees.
They were trying to make it for the hills up there, but they didn't make it.
A lot of people lost their homes.
Know what to do.
Know what to do.
Know what to do.
Know what to do.
Pacific prepared.
Pacific prepared.
Pacific prepared.
8:30 a.m. Fridays and 10:30 a.m. Saturdays, PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Jordan Fennell with you here on Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. And still to come on the show in just a little bit, you will hear about the speculations that NRL greats Matty and Andrew Johns and Sonny Bill Williams could be joining Rugby League Samoa. Very interesting developments if that does come about. That's still to come. But first, I do have some music for you out of the UK. This is Estelle with Better.
Hit me up on the low. Don't you stop when we go. Keep me on tippy toes now. You love that thing when it poke out. You see when I'm walking away. You feel and you want me to stay. Let's leave, get away for the day. Top floor reservation. We could get comfortable. I get you comfortable. I show you something. Twist up that antidote. Show me that animal. Go ahead and give it all to me, baby. No one in the world. No one in the world.
From Estelle, that song there is Better. Now, the president of Rugby League Samoa says the prospect of NRL greats Matty and Andrew Johns and Sonny Bill Williams joining the national side's coaching setup for this year's World Cup is on the table. Tangaloa Fa'afuina Su'a says he is very open to the idea if a deal can be reached between the famous Australian trio and senior coach Matt Parrish, who has just been awarded a contract extension. As Richard Hewitt reports, were the three big names to join Toa Samoa's ranks. Many fans and many pundits believe the move would persuade top NRL players with Samoan heritage to switch their allegiance and create a formidable team, well capable of taking on world champions Australia.
For a number of years now, the feeling in rugby league circles has been that Samoa have underperformed on the big stage. But with the expertise and pulling power of Sonny Bill Williams and the Johns brothers on board, the suggestion is that the Samoan team could be transformed in much the same way that the Tongan team was at the last World Cup. Speaking on Channel 9 TV in Australia, Andrew Johns says at first the idea was simply being discussed very informally. But after his brother Matty went public on his own TV show, the situation escalated rapidly.
It was a very casual conversation, which I had with a couple of players. So I don't know moving forward what the plans are at Samoa, but I'd love at one stage to help out. And then briefly spoke to my brother and had a quick conversation with Sonny about it, Sonny Bill, and he said, oh, you come aboard, I'd love to help out. And then Matthew flapped his gums and it all went from there.
Now the suggestion is out there. The president of Rugby League Samoa, Tangaloa Fa'afuina Su'a, says he is as keen as anyone to make it happen.
It came as a surprise because we just found out on the TV show that it's stirring a lot of commotions with our fans, because usually if you want to be a coach, there are due process that you have to follow. Because we still also have some applications from some other coaches which are now in the pipeline. But, you know, the opportunity to have those high-profile players with their caliber and their skill, we have discussed the issue and we are very happy if that will eventuate this year. Because we're also looking at a succession planning once the World Cup is over.
Talks with national coach Matt Parrish are apparently going on behind the scenes, and Tangaloa believes the formation of a coaching panel is the way things are heading.
We would love to have them involved. It would be really good for the team by the sound off and the judgment with most of the feedback. The coaching staff in Australia, they are the ones consulting with them. We, the governments, we still haven't received any formal registration of their interest, but we're working on having them on board if the opportunity arrives. But the last meeting we had, Matt and our coaching staff, the guys in Australia, is that for them to contact the SPW and the John brothers if their intention is they really want to be part of the coaching staff so that we can move things forward. It would be really good if they can blend all together so that we can be able to do what's best for Samoa.
News of the star trio's interest in working with Toa Samoa sparked an outpouring on social media, mainly to the effect of calling for Matt Parrish to be dismissed and replaced by the Johns brothers and Sonny Bill. But Micah Felice, the NRL's in-country manager for Samoa, believes most of the disquiet is coming from outside the country.
Samoa is Samoa, but I see most of the comments are pretty much from overseas. At the moment, I'm not sure what's happening, but I saw a bit on the social media that Matt Parrish might be working together with the Johns brothers and Sonny Bill Williams. So people are just talking about that at the moment.
The RLS president says his aim is to try and get the best possible Toa Samoa team on the field at the World Cup. And having the Johns brothers and SBW on board could go a long way to making that happen. However, Tangaloa acknowledges that the fans' voices are important, although he too thinks the adverse comments about Matt Parish are coming mainly from the diaspora in Australia.
I believe so, but, you know, we also take into consideration the views of our supporters and fans worldwide, not just here in Samoa, because of the player base is mainly in Australia and overseas. I cannot promise anything, but I'm sure that by the looks of case of other Pacific nations who have managed to put together the best team in the past and they came out really well. By the look of things, some of the boys, I think they're really keen to have the chance bringing their expertise in the team, and SBW as well is a star and be good to push the morale of the team.
Micah Felice says a Toa Samoa dream team would be a match for anyone, but it may require the influence and pulling power of three of the biggest names in the game to make that happen.
It would be great to have all of them all in one team to help Samoa out, but it's always the case for Samoa. They put their hand up, but when it comes down to the deadline, they go back to other teams, to other countries. So it would be great to see all these top-level Islander players come back to Samoa. It will give them a great boost.
And when you look at what Tonga have done at the last World Cup, and indeed since the last World Cup, if you sat down and wrote a list of the 13 Samoan players that you would like to see in the starting lineup for Toa Samoa, they would be a match for Tonga and possibly even better, wouldn't they?
If a dream team of mine come true, there will definitely be a match for Tonga and other countries as well, because these are all high-level NRL players. So they're going to be a very, very hard team to stop.
And if having Sonny Bill and the Johns brothers on board wasn't incentive enough, it's a move that Andrew Johns says wouldn't cost Rugby League Samoa a cent.
Do it for nothing. We need the international game to thrive. So whatever they're going to pay me, put back in the pool for where they stay and infrastructure within the camps, but also give that money back to the players, give them incentive to play.
So with all the ingredients there and money not a problem, if an agreement can't be reached to bring the three-star names on board, Toa Samoa fans, wherever they are, may be entitled to ask, why not?
Richard Hewitt's reporting there. My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. And right now I'm going to take you to a newsroom in Solomon Islands to the popular Solomon Business magazine, where Robert Iroga is the owner of the magazine and also its website, SBM Online. It's developed a reputation as the place to find the latest news and stories from the Solomons. And Robert joins me on the line from Honiara. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Jordan.
Robert, I wanted to start by chatting with you about the vaccination rollout in Solomon Islands. The World Health Organization has given the green light for the Chinese-made vaccine Sinopharm to be used. 50,000 doses are already on standby. Do you know when they're going to be rolled out?
Well, the Prime Minister has announced on Monday that he's giving the decision to the National Drugs and Medicines and Therapeutical Committee. They will be looking at it, and soon they will advise him back. They started looking at since Monday, and I'm not really sure at this stage as to when the rollout of the Sinopharm will start here in the Solomons.
And what is the feeling on the ground about this Chinese vaccine, Sinopharm? It's the first vaccine from China to be approved by the World Health Organization. How are people feeling about it?
Well, there's a mixed feeling on the ground. And from what I received from comments from the people is that a lot are not quite interested in coming forward to be vaccinated with this Sinopharm, but the government has assured that it has been approved by the World Health Organization. Therefore, it can be used and it's safe for it to be used in the Solomon. So, yeah, there's a mixed feeling. And even with AstraZeneca vaccine, there was so much a mixed feeling. But at the end of the day, a lot of people came out in the last day to be vaccinated. But if I could compare them, I think the Sinopharm, it's not that a lot of people wouldn't want to be vaccinated with this Sinopharm.
And is the government doing anything to combat this? You were saying there that health authorities were trying to reassure people that it is safe to be able to take this vaccine. Are there any campaigns being rolled out across the country to increase that trust in vaccinations?
So far, not yet, but they have been campaigning and encouraging people to come forward when we started the rollout with AstraZeneca on this. Not yet. I hope when, also not so much hope, but I believe that when the now the WHO was given the approval, the government will step forward and do more awareness on this vaccine so that people can come forward and be vaccinated.
Now, Australia has also announced that it's providing more vaccines to Solomon Islands. How many doses is Australia providing?
Well, it's quite interesting. The same day that the Prime Minister, and not long after WHO agreed to the Chinese vaccine to be used, Australia came out on Monday as well to say that they are giving 60,000 doses, but they will come in 10,000 in shipment. And it'll be like six times, so it'll be 60,000, and that will be of AstraZeneca, that is 1 million Australia. Just going back to the Chinese made vaccine Sinopharm, I had actually spoken to the people at the Chinese embassy, and they said about 7,000 Chinese who are in the Solomons, they are willing, very much willing, and look forward to be vaccinated with the Sinopharm.
It'll definitely be interesting to see the uptake, across the entire country of those different vaccines. You're listening to Robert Iroga. He's the owner of Solomon's Business Magazine, speaking with me here on Pacific Beat. Robert, I wanted to turn to another story. It's quite tragic, one that's recently come out of Solomon's. You live on Lingakiki Ridge in Honiara, I understand, which is the same ridge where a massive explosion on Sunday killed one person and injured three others. You were one of the first to publish about this. Tell me a little bit about how that unfolded.
Well, you're right. I'm just meters away from where the accident took place. It happened around 3 p.m. on Sunday noon when a group of young people, they were cooking some food outside of a house, and eventually a bomb, World War II bomb, got exploded, severely injuring three others, as well as one person died, unfortunately, as a result of the bomb, and he was really badly injured. And that was they were actually cooking outside, not in a house, but just in a garden. I actually went there just a few or less than an hour after the incident took place.
And were you nearby when this happened?
Yeah, I was a bit far, but I could hear the explosion. It was so serious, and then I headed straight to the scene, and I saw carnage all over the place, and the people from the EOD who actually are dealing with the bomb here in the Solomons, they were actually already there on the scene. And yeah, it's so sad to see people badly injured. Some probably will be losing their limbs. Probably some of the hands will be gone as well after they recovered, but I hope they will fully recover after this. But the injuries are so sad.
Yeah, absolutely tragic. And obviously this is one of a couple of deaths that has happened recently because of this. Obviously thousands of World War II bombs have been left in Solomon Islands since the war. And this incident seems to have sparked quite a bit of debate about whether or not the US and Japan should have a responsibility to clear up this legacy of these bombs that have been left behind. What are people saying in Solomon's?
Absolutely, that's what you were just saying. Is the two are responsible, but there seems to be a huge anger against the U.S. here in the Solomons, and because they say the U.S. the ones who actually left the bombs, and they actually bombed a lot of places on these islands, and they should be fully responsible. And a lot didn't agree with the statement issued by the ambassador based in Port Moresby, responsible for the Solomons, on what he said about the incident, and they said that what she was saying was not good enough and they should come and remove the mess here.
And have there been calls from the people in Seoul's to the Solomon Islands government to take any action on this?
You will be hearing more, I suspect, in the coming days, and it will become a huge issue. A lot of people have called me to say that they are organising some events, probably marches, or organizing some public talks or awareness on pressurizing the government to ensure that the foreign governments that are responsible must also be responsible for taking up the mess. Yeah, I've just spoken to somebody who had worked in the EOD here in the Solomons, and he was basically saying that it's a lot of explosive ordinances are still unexploded, still left in Honiara, and most of the houses here probably sit on them. So he said there should be a huge task for the governments of Japan and the US to help our government to remove them.
Well, definitely something that I'm sure you'll be continuing across watching this, bringing us news of these developments out of Solomon Islands. But Robert Iroga, thank you very much for coming on the show this morning and updating us about the situation in Seoul at the moment.
Thank you.
That was Solomon's Business Magazine journalist and owner, Robert Iroga, speaking with me there. Jordan Fennell with you here on Pacific Beat. And we're coming up soon to the news. But first, I do have some music for you. This is Falau and Josh Namalea with Locker Siliva. Beautiful voices out of Tonga. That is Falau and Josh Namaleng with Loka Siliva. And that takes us to the end of the first hour of Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. But stick around for the next hour, because coming up, I will have a story for you about Australia's budget that's just been outlined. And unfortunately, it's bad news for the Pacific. There are cuts to aid across the board. And we'll have an update on that for you. And also, you'll hear from a Chamorro woman from Guam whose indigenous food recipes have gone viral on TikTok. That's still to come, but right now you're coming up to 5 minutes of the news. Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Jordan Fennell. Very happy Wednesday morning to you. Coming up this hour, after another death in Solomon Islands caused by a World War II bomb exploding, calls for a cleanup of unexploded ordnance in the country are growing louder. That's coming up very shortly. You'll hear from people on the ground in Solomon Islands on their thoughts about this. And also coming up, when COVID-19 lockdowns forced her inside, one woman from Guam decided to start sharing indigenous recipes on TikTok.
So I moved into TikTok based on some recommendations from my nephew. And I made my very first recipe was what we call Hanexa Agaget, which is red rice. And that particular video got 40,000 views in less than 3 days.
Pretty impressive. Her story coming up in about half an hour. But first, Australia has cut money to aid in its new budget.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Experts in international development are accusing Australia of reducing foreign aid at a time when it's most needed during the COVID-19 pandemic. The Australian Treasurer has delivered the national budget for the next financial year, and it contains $144 million cut to money the government will set aside to help other countries, many in the Pacific, respond to COVID-19. As Marion Farr reports, it's an outcome that's been met with criticism from analysts who say it sends a bad message about Australia's generosity on a global scale.
Since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, Pacific countries have relied heavily on Australia for assistance. But a year on, and the region is still battling with the virus.
Of concern is the potential for what we're expecting is a third wave, like what India is seeing now, but at a later date. And that third wave may see more cases of coronavirus and potentially more serious cases of coronavirus needing hospitalisation.
Matt Cannon is the CEO of St John Ambulance in Papua New Guinea. He's been instrumental in setting up a COVID-19 isolation facility at an aquatic centre in PNG's capital, Port Moresby, with funding from the Australian government. The money was announced in March, when cases in PNG began to spike dramatically.
So the Aquatic Centre consolidated the COVID response for Port Moresby. It's a 200 or so bed capacity for patients with coronavirus.
Over the past financial year, the Australian government has put $480 million into helping other countries respond to the COVID-19 crisis. The large majority of that has gone to the Pacific. The funding meant a small increase to Australia's overall foreign aid budget after years of successive cuts. But according to the country's 2021-22 budget delivered last night, COVID-19 funding for overseas countries is set to drop by more than $144 million to $335 million in the next financial year. The government has classed the assistance as a supplementary measure, separate to its official overseas development assistance, which is set to stay the same at $4 billion. But experts say the fall in COVID-19 funding represents a 5% overall decrease in Australian foreign aid.
I think the bottom line is that the government has decided to cut aid in the coming budget year.
Dr. Stephen Howes is head of the Development Policy Centre, a think tank for international development at the Australian National University. He says last night's budget crushed hopes that Australia might continue its effective boost to foreign aid seen over the past year.
You know, because the Australian economy is doing better than expected, and because, the global pandemic is probably doing worse than people expected, I think there was some hope there would be further initiatives announced, or at least that there wouldn't be any cuts in the total aid amount. I certainly didn't expect this budget to have a 5% real aid cut built into it.
It's a concern for Mark Purcell, CEO of the Australian Council for International Development, Australia's umbrella group for NGOs.
Look, it's really alarming. We've got COVID in a terrible third wave across our region. We've got bodies washing up on the Ganges in India, and in PNG, because the testing is so poor, we don't even know the rates of infection. And except for a small announcement for medical assistance to India of $16 million, there is no new money to resource the government's strategy to tackle COVID in our part of the world in this budget.
But while overall foreign aid might appear to be on the decline, some Pacific countries have fared better in the Australian budget than others. Within the region, Fiji is the biggest winner, with a forecast increase of $15.6 million in development assistance for the next financial year. Samoa is also set to receive a modest increase in aid. And while PNG will remain by far the biggest recipient of Australian money, its share of ODA funding will fall slightly to $588 million. The budget will also see Australia boost its diplomatic presence over the next 4 years, with almost two dozen new diplomatic positions at over 20 overseas posts. It comes after the nation opened new embassies in the Marshall Islands and French Polynesia earlier this month, a move seen by some analysts as an attempt to counter China's growing competition for influence in the Pacific. Director of the Lowy Institute, Jonathan Pryke, supports the additional funding for Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs.
This is absolutely welcome. You know, the DFAT's budget has remained stagnant for decades now. And whilst we've seen defence go through the roof, development and diplomacy, these are all three pillars of a unified foreign policy, have been really run down.
But when it comes to COVID-19, Mark Purcell from the Australian Council for International Development believes Australia can and must do more.
The government always has the ability to make additional measures to respond to the third wave of COVID sweeping across Asia and into neighbours in the Pacific like PNG. It can do that at any time. We hope that they will. And I think we're going to need it because the scale of need is very, very high.
Mark Purcell from the Australian Council for International Development, ending Marion Farr's report. Taking you now over to Solomon Islands, where there's been another death caused by a World War II bomb exploding, and calls for a cleanup of unexploded ordnance in the country are growing louder. Razif Hilly, a 29-year-old aviation engineer, died in hospital, and three other people are in a critical condition after the weekend explosion. The police say a group of young people were cooking on an open fire just metres away from their family home when the abandoned shell buried nearby blew up. Dr. Claude Pasala is a close relative of Razif Hilly.
Razif is quite a young, energetic young man who has been a good role model for his youth at his local church and for other youths as well, and even a father figure for his two nephews. And it's going to be a real loss for the family that he has gone, and a loss for his church and community, and even for his workplace as well. And he has such a bright future in front of him. But unfortunately, you know, the incident that happened on Sunday just ended all of that.
Now, there are still thousands of tons of unexploded munitions littered across the Pacific, and progress to clean up this deadly legacy is really slow, nearly 80 years after the conflict ended. ABC Radio Australia asked listeners whether the US and Japan should be forced to cover the cost of the cleanup, and quite a few of you got back to us to let us know what you think. Gino Ramo was one of them. He told ABC Radio Australia he's worried there will be more deaths in Honiara.
World War II didn't happen yesterday. This cleanup should have happened in the 60s and 70s, when it could have been much easier. In the case of Honiara today, the city is densely populated, and God knows how many unexploded ordnances lay underneath or next to people's homes.
Polo also got in touch via Facebook. He wrote that although the war is long since gone, the sting left behind with UXO still remains almost a century after. Why is innocent blood still being shed today when there is new technology available to assist the process of finding and removing them from deeper in the ground? And Carl Cooper sent ABC Radio Australia a voice memo to the Facebook page. He says that the US and Japan have a responsibility to act.
Hello, Radio Australia. Now, obviously, Solomon Islands is littered with tons of unexploded ordnances, bombs and ammunition left over from World War II. This will continue to forever provide a threat to the lives and livelihood of us living here. They won't disappear, and any right-minded person would know that something needs to be done about this. Now, the Solomon Islands government does not have the resources and capabilities to undertake this mammoth task alone. So who best to help than those that came to put the bombs here in the first place?
Carl Cooper, who sent in that voice memo to the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page. And if you have an opinion, if you're in Solomon Islands and you'd like to join in the conversation, please head over to the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page. Get in touch. You can leave a comment on any of our stories or send through a voice memo like Carl with your thoughts. I'd love to hear them. Jordan Fennell with you here on Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. And still to come on the show, you're going to get an update about the vaccine rollout in the Torres Strait. A brand new super cold fridge has just been delivered in order to keep those vaccines at the right temperature. An update coming for you in about 10 minutes. And also still to come, you're going to hear from Jessica Ignacio. She's a Chamorro woman from Guam who during lockdown, she's actually living in California. California at the moment, in lockdown in the United States, she decided to take to TikTok to share her indigenous food recipes, and they've gone viral. It's very, very impressive. You'll hear her story coming up in about 15 minutes. But right now, I do have a song for you. This is from Josh Tatoffee with You're Perfect to Me.
But I know one thing, I'm in love with my best friend. Hey, have you ever sat and wondered why the birdies sing? Or how the sun leaves our horizon and comes back again? I can see how we don't have that picture perfect kind of love. But I know one thing, I'm in love with my best friend. That's perfect to me. Ooh, yeah. Perfect to me.
Out of Hawaii, that was Josh Tatoffee with Perfect to Me. Well, time now to get a quick update on all the news making headlines around the region. And I'm joined by Richard Hewitt. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Jordan.
Richard, let's start with more news on the COVID-19 situation in the Pacific. More vaccine supplies are set to be delivered to Solomon Islands.
Yeah, we were hearing a little earlier in the program about the 50,000 doses of Sinopharm. This is the Chinese-manufactured vaccine, which has now been approved by the WHO. 50,000 doses already in Solomon Islands. But now Australia has kind of upped the ante, if you like, gone from 50,000 to 60,000 doses they're prepared to offer of the AstraZeneca vaccine. And if it goes ahead, as it looks likely that it will be delivered at the rate of 10,000 doses a week. The Solomons, one of four countries in the region, along with Fiji, PNG and Timor-Leste, that have been prioritised to receive supplies of that vaccine, quantities of which will be produced here in Melbourne. Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare has accepted the Australian offer. He says the National Drugs, Medicine and Therapeutic Committee will be meeting soon to consider approval and a distribution plan. Meanwhile, in Nauru, a bit of a curiosity this, the COVID-19 vaccination campaign there has exceeded government expectations. Nauru, of course, remains COVID-19 free, and you would think it will probably stay that way, because an official statement tells us that 7,392 people have received a first dose of vaccine. And according to the official statement, that's 108% of the adult population. It's a bit of a quirk based on the numbers that were recorded as being on the island in the last census and the number of people that have actually been vaccinated. Hence, they come up with this figure of 108%.
Not a bad news headline figure to be putting out there.
108%.
Exactly. And as you were mentioning there, Richard, for listeners who have just joined us, in the first hour of Pacific Beat, I did chat with Solomon's Business Magazine owner, Robert Iroga, all about getting an update on the vaccination rollout there in Solomon Islands. More vaccines from China and Australia. But he was saying some hesitancy from people on the ground there about vaccines, and people can listen back to that online a bit later on in the day. But Richard, turning now to some rugby news, breaking news on the rugby front, actually, in New Zealand, and good news for the Pacific.
Yes, One News has been telling its viewers in New Zealand that New Zealand rugby are in discussions over playing a test match against Tonga, with Mount Smart and Waikato stadiums in the mix to host that game. There's more, with a potential clash between Manu Samoa and the Māori All Blacks on the cards for the same date. That will be July the 3rd. And the All Blacks will also be playing back-to-back tests against the Flying Fijians on July the 10th and 17th, with venues to be confirmed. Now, New Zealand have never played back-to-back tests against the Pacific Island team before, and in the last 4 years, Tonga is the only Pacific side they've played at all. So why is all this happening now? Why the sudden interest from New Zealand in playing Pacific teams? Well, essentially, it's all down to COVID-19, with Italy calling off their proposed tour. The New Zealand authorities, for once, have decided to look in their own backyard for some opposition. It will be nice to think that more of these matches, though, will be played in the post-COVID world. And as a postscript, I should mention the two-leg World Cup playoff between Tonga and Samoa. Those matches matches were due to be played in Apia and Nuku'alofa, but now both will be played in New Zealand again because of the COVID-19 travel situation. And also in July, Manasina Samoa will be playing Australia's women's team, the Wallaroos, in Brisbane. That's part of a doubleheader that will also feature the Wallabies up against France, unless, of course, the French don't make the trip, which I suppose is a possibility. Were that to happen, there may be another opportunity for a Pacific team. So after no rugby at all, really, for a long time, we're in a bit of a glut.
Lots of rugby.
Well, but for the Pacific, they've been hard done by. New Zealand have really gone out of their way not to play Pacific teams, and Australia, frankly, haven't been much better. So, I mean, it would be good.
I found that quite surprising. I didn't realise that New Zealand had only played Tonga.
Because there's no money, you see. There's no money. If they take a trip to Nuku'alofa or they take a trip to Apia, they don't make any money. And they'd far rather be playing one of the Tier 1 teams from elsewhere in the world.
Do it for the love of the sport.
Well, do it for the fact that half their team have got Pacific heritage as well.
Exactly.
Might be a good thing.
Interesting. Now, we still have a little bit more rugby news, actually, from you, because we finally have three of our rugby sevens teams that now know what they have to do to make it to the Tokyo Olympics. What do they know?
Well, they know it's going to be tough. I mean, I guess we always thought that would be the case, but the draw has been made for the men's and women's repechage, which will decide which men's team and women's team get the last two Olympic places, one each in Japan. The playoffs will be in Monaco, so the first tough bit is actually getting to Monaco. I mean, if you think, for example, you know, Samoa, I struggle to get out of Samoa, never mind get to Monaco.
Yes.
But we leave that on one side. There will be some sort of team there representing Samoa and Tonga, and they will be in the same pool with Ireland, Zimbabwe and Mexico. Now, that to me suggests that Samoa would be pretty well placed to go through to the semi-finals. Tonga, maybe. If they both make it as the top two, then they clearly can't play each other in the semi-finals. So if they were then to win their semi-finals, they would play each other in an all-Pacific final for the Olympic spot. That would be the ideal situation. But a lot of work to do before that happens. In the women's event, our only representatives are Papua New Guinea. They are the top-ranked team, though, in their pool with Kazakhstan, Jamaica and Tunisia. So therefore, basically, as a top-ranked team, they should come through on paper and make the semi-finals. Problem is, once they get to the last four, they probably will come up against teams like Russia, France, Argentina. So if Papua New Guinea's women's team do make it to the Olympics, they will have done it the hard way, and it would be an enormous achievement for them.
Yeah. Sounds like it's a long road, but if they can get there, I'm sure rugby fans everywhere are very excited to watch that all play out.
We just hope it doesn't, as far as Samoa are concerned, that they missed out in the last second of the final of the repechage 4 years ago. Broke fans' hearts and led to the dismissal of the coach, Damien McGrath. Ostensibly, I think it's generally believed that the Prime Minister couldn't face the fact that Samoa were not going to the Olympics and Fiji, who then went on to win the gold medal, were.
Oh, God. So hoping that history does not repeat itself.
Oh, absolutely. The tension was palpable that night. Well, that night, it was the middle of the night for us, early morning here. I remember it well.
Look, I'm sure you'll be very excited to watch this all play out, and we'll get many updates from you, Richard. But thank you very much for bringing us those stories.
Pleasure.
Now let's take a quick look at the weather from the capital cities across the region. In Port Moresby, it will be cloudy today with some patchy rain and an expected top of 31 degrees. In Honiara, also rainy, and thunderstorms are expected with a high of 30 degrees. Over in Nuku'alofa, partly cloudy, a little bit cooler as well with a top of just 27 degrees. Port Vila, also expecting a top of 27 degrees, and you'll have brief showers across the day. Over in Suva, a strong wind warning does remain in place as it did yesterday. You're expecting a cloudy day with some showers and a top of 28 degrees. And finally in Apia, cloudy and rainy today with a top of 30 degrees.
Hi, I'm Matt from Pacific Playtime. Pacific Playtime is a show for kids and their grown-ups on ABC Radio Australia. It's all about listening, learning and having fun. We'll learn new things and discover the world around us.
Have you ever noticed that people wear shoes, but other animals don't really wear shoes? Have you ever seen an elephant wearing shoes?
No.
We'll even learn some new words.
The word I want to teach you today is nagula. Can you say nagula?
Nagula.
Nagula means salt water, of the ocean or sea.
Join me each Saturday morning at 7:30 and Sunday morning at 5:30 PNG time only on ABC Radio Australia.
Jordan Fennell with you here on Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm taking you now to the Torres Strait, where the most anticipated fridge in the history of the Torres Strait has arrived. And it's not storing any of the region's famous seafood. Instead, a new super cold freezer has been shipped to Australia's northernmost islands to keep the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine cool. But how islanders will respond is unclear after an AstraZeneca rollout was scrapped last month. Adam Stephen has been speaking to the Executive Director of Medical Services at Torres and Cape Hospital, Dr. Tony Brown, who will be leading the delivery of the new vaccine.
Yeah, well, it took some work, but fortunately the urgency of the requirement, you know, allowed us to get this very rare commodity. So it's been shipped up and arrived on Thursday and very late last week.
Now that you've got the freezer, how long will it take before you can actually recommence the rollout of vaccines to the Torres Strait?
Oh, once the vaccine arrives, which is going to be, we're hoping tomorrow, if not the next day, then we are pretty well ready to go because we've got everything lined up to recommence the rollout on the 17th of May.
Just the freezer alone is a big jag, but it's not the only link in the logistics chain, is it? Once you've got the freezer there at Thursday Island, you still need to get this vaccine out to the more remote islands that are still a plane ride or a boat ride away from Thursday Island.
Yeah, that's right. So we've got to make sure the so-called cold chain is kept intact. So, but the fortunate thing is that we can bring the vaccine down to normal vaccine temperatures for 2 weeks prior to use, and then we can, once we've got it to two, then we can get it down to 2 to 8 degrees centigrade for 5 days to give it to the community members. So we have worked out a way that we can keep the vaccine viable so it can do its good work when we deliver it.
Most of the rollout of Pfizer around the world has been in developed countries and in cities. You're tackling this in a very remote part of Australia. Are you in some ways kind of pioneering what might be done with Pfizer in other parts of the country?
Oh, absolutely. It has been a big piece of work. It's been a logistical exercise of a large order, especially for such a small organisation. And we put our best team on the job, and they've come up with a great plan. And I'm very sure it's going to be a great success.
Are there any concerns around vaccine hesitancy, given that the AstraZeneca rollout was paused last month by authorities?
Yeah, absolutely. The community have lost a bit of confidence in the rollout, so we are doing a big piece of work around gaining the trust of our community, because this is a very important mechanism to protect them from COVID. So we're doing a lot of community consultation. I'm going out to Horn Island tomorrow, and we're doing community consultation on Thursday Island in the rest of the week, because we're rolling it out on Thursday Island for the first 2 weeks.
What will happen to those who have already had their first AstraZeneca jab? We do know that at three of the outer islands, the health service had been vaccinating people with the AstraZeneca vaccine before the decision was made to scrap the rollout. So what happens to the 800 or so Torres Strait Islanders that have had one dose of AstraZeneca?
Well, we're going to go back. We're going to once again do community consultation and communication early, and then we're going to offer the second dose of AstraZeneca to these people. We know the second dose is safer than the first dose, and we had no adverse reactions with the first dose. So we're going out to those islands in that 12-week period, the side by Borgu and Doan, and we'll be providing for the people in Hammond and Horn who also got the vaccine.
Is there still concern among locals about the threat that COVID-19 might present, given they are so close to Papua New Guinea?
Yeah, well, that's been the main driver, that the COVID pandemic is escalating in Papua New Guinea, and we're so close and we've got such a vulnerable population. So a lot of concern amongst our community members and elders, and therefore that's why it's so important that we get them all vaccinated.
We're hearing from Dr. Tony Brown with the Torres and Cape Hospital and Health Service. What happens if you can't convince people to get a second shot of AstraZeneca? Will that present a challenge? Do you get any kind of benefit from just one shot?
You do get benefit from the first shot. That's absolutely the truth. And but we do recommend that second shot to give you the most protection you can get to protect your community, your family and yourself from this disease once it comes into back into Australia and we open up our borders. So we do need to protect everyone, and it's a very important part of that response.
How long do you expect the rollout to take through the Torres Strait? Now, you've got the freezer there. You say once the vaccines arrive, the rollout will recommence. And how long are you expecting it will take to give everyone in the Torres Strait that wants their vaccinations, both doses?
So we're planning to have it finished by the end of December. So we've got the whole of the Torres and Cape planned, two visits to each community, providing, as you say, the AstraZeneca to those who already had their first dose and Pfizer to everyone else.
It's been reported that some of the Indigenous communities at the top of Cape York or around the top of Cape York will get vaccinations starting from September. Can you confirm this is the case?
Yeah, so, well, we've got the... I'd have to go and have a look at my exact rollout, but certainly, no, the Cape York gets a bit earlier than that, but certainly we're going to have a crossover period between the when we do the Torres and we start in the Cape and we start around Weipa.
Now, of course, you're focused on getting Australian citizens vaccinated, but we do know that they keep saying this, until everyone's vaccinated, it's a global problem. So we are going to need to vaccinate people in remote parts of the world. Do you think the lessons learnt through the rollout through the Torres Strait and Cape York, which are pretty remote and do present significant logistical challenges, do you think these might be lessons that can be used in other countries through the Pacific where Australia may end up playing a role?
I think so. And we have had some organisations seeking our advice already on how such a logistical process could be run.
Dr. Tony Brown, Executive Director of Medical Services at Torres and Cape Hospital, and he was speaking there to Adam Stephen. My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat, and I hope you're having a very wonderful start to your Wednesday morning, especially because still to come, I do have a great story for you. It's about a woman from Guam, and during her lockdown in the United States, she took to TikTok and also Instagram to share Indigenous Chamorro recipes, and they went viral. It's a very, very impressive story. She managed to rack up 40,000 views in 3 days on one particular recipe about red rice. People, it seems, very keen for stories about food and knowledge about Indigenous food from around the Pacific. So that's coming up very, very soon. But right now, I do have a song for you out of New Zealand. This is the Polynesian group Te Waka with Mana Malohi. Te Waka there with their song Mana Malohi. I've got a question for you. If you've had to go through a COVID-19 lockdown perhaps sometime last year, or if you're actually in Fiji right now and going through your own
lockdown containment zone situation. What did you end up doing, or what are you doing to pass the time? A lot of people I know have turned to food, some for comfort eating, sitting on the couch, no need to go outside and exercise, just hang out and eat some junk food. Others took up cooking. I was one of those people. Technically, I took up baking. I became quite obsessed with it while I was in lockdown here in Melbourne. Got obsessed with watching the Great British Bake Off and then recreating all the different desserts that they were making on that show. It was delicious and I definitely do not regret it at all. So if you're in lockdown at the moment, baking is a great thing to take up. And one particular woman who is currently going through her own lockdown at the moment is Jessica Ignacio Maisa. She's a Chamorro woman from Guam living in the United States, and she decided to start a cooking channel showing off all her indigenous food knowledge. And when she put it up on TikTok, it went viral. I spoke with Jessica to find out more.
Hafidé. For those of you who are new to this channel, I wanted to take a minute to introduce myself. My name is Jessica, and I'm the creator of the Chamorro Cooking Channel. I actually just got my stickers in, so I'm super stoked about that.
My name is Jessica Ignacio Maisa. I was raised on the island of Guam since I was 9 years old until I left when I was 24. And now I reside in California. Before COVID, I ran an adventure blog called Sunsets with Kids. And that was really surrounded around the adventures and activities I do with my two boys and my husband. And immediately, COVID forced me to stop doing those adventures. And because of the lockdown, I was home and I was cooking a lot. And I realized a lot of the foods that I like to cook on repeat, they're beautiful foods, basically because I'm culturally connected to them, but also because I feel like there's a lot of color in the foods we make. I thought to myself, I've always loved sharing foods and how to make them to other people. And I thought that this would be the perfect platform and opportunity to bring it to life. In addition to my pride of being a Chamorro woman, I thought that it would be the perfect place to start. A lot of times, the foods we've learned back home are my parents and or my aunties and uncles. They cook the meals and they don't follow recipes. They don't follow measurements. They do it all by hand. And I thought, if we're now trying to preserve the culture that we are so proud of, how are we to teach this to our children if I can't tell them, oh, let's use one cup of flour or use, you know, 2 teaspoons of vanilla? So I thought, you know what, it's time for someone to share it beautifully in a way where we're showing recipes and measurements specifically.
And so if, you know, your relatives or your parents or grandparents, if they didn't use measurements, how did you figure out how to make your own measurements for the traditional dishes that I guess you grew up learning and cooking about?
So, you know, some of the recipes that I have already shared, my aunts or uncles would give me like a general guide of what to use. So I repurposed their recipes. I tested it out multiple times before sharing it out because I wanted to make sure that it was accurate and it came out correctly. So they gave me a guide and they gave me some basic recipes to follow. And then some of the other recipes are shared through other family members, you know, and friends that I've made out here in California that are from Guam originally.
This is a really important part because if you let it sit, it will burn. And the truth is you don't want it burned because that's gross. But you just need to keep mixing for a long time.
Did you, before you started, I guess, with this particular Chamorro cooking channel, were you already teaching your own children about all these different recipes?
I was. As a matter of fact, fried rice is a big one because that's just generally when my family comes together. I end up becoming the breakfast person and fried rice was my thing. Munhe Tatizas, which is young coconut made into what my neighbor likes to call, because I bring her Munhe Tatizas as a gift. She calls it Guam pancakes, but it really is just young coconut made into like a tortilla. So those were dishes that I'd commonly make in my home already. And I bring my little 8-year-old loves to cook. So he's always my little chef in the kitchen. So I do try to get them involved so they can be familiar with the dishes we make.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I love the guam pancakes. That sounds absolutely delicious. I feel like that's something that I'm going to need to try for breakfast at some point, maybe this weekend.
Absolutely.
Now that you've taken it, I guess maybe when you first started and brought it onto social media, what sort of reaction did you initially get? Did you find that everything was quite popular, or have you sort of had to work and tweak the way you produce content to get people more involved and engaged in it?
So I started in January. I started on the Instagram platform, and I immediately started a website because I figured it needed a home. The feedback I was getting based on the stories and the recipes was pretty immediate. Honestly, I feel like there has been a very supporting and loving and like, we needed this type of vibe. And I love that. And I think I feed off of that energy. So when I had hit a little bit of a snafu with Instagram, I guess one of those like robots imitated my account. And when I reported it to Instagram, they shut my account down for 4 days.
Oh no.
So when that happened, I realized, okay, now I need to make sure that I'm on all other platforms. So I moved into TikTok based on some recommendations from my nephew.
Hop a day. Today, I'm going to teach you how to make a delicious appetizer from the island of Guam. But first, here's your recipe list, as well as a beautiful pictorial of what that all looks like prepped and ready to go. And here's my son, Austin. He's my little helper in the kitchen, and today he's going to debone our rotisserie chicken. We're going to break that up. Chop, 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 chop. This is what
I created the channel on a Sunday. And I made my very first recipe was what we call Hanexa Agaget, which is red rice. It's a common Chamorro dish used at almost every, or served at every festivity. And immediately I have 3,500 followers on TikTok, and that particular video got 40,000 views in less than 3 days. So
wow.
It tells me that there is an audience out there, and I'm realizing that there's a very young audience on TikTok. So there's people that want to know how to make our dishes, and they're curious and they want to see it. And so many people have left home and they've tried our food, but they don't know how to recreate it. And they want to see visual step by step. So it's grown very quickly.
How often are you posting? Do you do it every day, or is it like a weekly thing?
So I've been trying to do at least one or two recipes per week. I do have a full-time job simultaneously. So I'm trying to balance out recipes with some of the stories that I've also used I have series of stories that I've also shared, which is also thriving.
And what are the focus of the stories in particular that you're trying to highlight?
There's two specifically. The first one that I started was called Tiempo en Historia, which means story time in Chamorro. And that's based off of the premise of sharing stories from contributed by people that I've asked, like, hey, you know, do you want to share or feature a dish that you've made, and share with me who's inspired you to cook in the kitchen and who introduced you to the kitchen and you've now been inspired. And then my second one is called Biscutsu Stories. And Biscutsu in Chamorro is biscuits. After the war, we were, many Chamorros survived off of, you know, things that were shipped in from Japan or from the U.S. to survive, which is a big reason why a lot of us rely on canned meats or the dry crackers in this case, or dry biscuits. And that particular cracker or biscuit has been it's such an intimate snack because it's almost like the superstar of what we call merienda, which is like an afternoon snack. And that would bring people together. And a lot of the memories that people recall of Biscutsu was sitting down at the table together with their grandparents or maybe their aunties and uncles. And it was a moment to connect, drink coffee, and enjoy that time together. And it's as simple as a cracker or a biscuit like that that has really had people reflect on memories and people in their lives that have passed. And it's one of the ones that I'm actually really proud of showcasing because it really has brought people together.
Do you have any particularly strong memories from perhaps growing up or even recently that is so connected to your Chamorro food?
Yes, it's the art of gathering. I was I moved from Germany. My dad was in the U.S. Army, and we moved when he retired from Germany to Guam in 1992. And I won't go into detail, but I eventually my stepmom ended up raising us, and my stepmom's family all took us in. You know, they immediately treated us like family. We never felt different, and all of my mom's brothers and sisters were always there. I have so many fond memories of them in the kitchen together. And we would, you know, we would make big dishes together. Someone was always assigned to doing the, you know, the chopping of the onions, the chopping of the garlic. Someone else is smashing the shrimp or shrimp patties. And, you know, there's somebody might be, you know, killing a pig and preparing that. There's just so much connection and gathering, you know, hosted by being raised on the island of Guam. Coming together is just so natural. And because the island's so small, and that this may be the same for you and your memories as well. Like, there's something about that art of gathering and coming together, and that just feeling like we're really truly raising our children in a village environment. And that's something that I miss profoundly from being back home. And that's what I'm trying to recreate being out here in California.
That was Jessica Ignacio Mesa, founder of the Chamorro Cooking Channel. And if you want to check out any of her recipes, you can head over to TikTok or Instagram and just search for Chamorro Cooking Channel. Now, the seasonal labour shortage in Australia has opened the doors for Pacific workers to make the trip even during a pandemic and help out with the harvest. But the pandemic or no pandemic, seasonal work may soon be a thing of the past, with researchers working on the development of the fastest fruit and vegetable picking robot they can make. The challenge is to create a commercially viable robot that would eventually replace a human picker. And Dr. Chow Chen from the Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering at Monash University in Melbourne has developed a robot that can pick apples at the rate of 1 every 9 seconds.
So we developed our robotic vision system. So it will take images and to do the mapping of the tree. And then our algorithm will detect and where's the apple and also locate the apple. So this information will be transformed to the central control system.
Right. And based on the tests so far, how successful has it been at picking fruit?
In average, the success rate of harvesting apple is about 85% according to our experiment. So this is within the workspace of the robot.
Right. And has it encountered problems or issues?
Yes, and we do encounter some difficulties. And for example, if an apple is blocked by a leaf, we still can detect it, but then the leaf will block the view so that partially, so this will give us the incorrect depth information so that for this type of apple, we have difficult to reach. And also some apples is close to the main branch and also closer to wiring and in the farm. So these apples, one of gripper approach this apple, they can tangle with the branch and the wire. So this is also another difficulty.
Hmm. There's been a surge of research into robots picking fruit on farms. Is the idea here to have a robot that assists human pickers or to replace the seasonal harvest worker altogether? What's your long-term aim, I guess, with this research?
We would like to develop the robot to work with the human together. So currently, we would like to see that our robot is able to work at nighttime in bad weather conditions, which human pickers may not be willing to work on. So this is my vision on how the robot should be applied. And also, human picker has high dexterity in removing the apple and from some complicated situation. So we would also thinking that the robot should work with human together to improve the efficiency.
How far away do you think we are from robots being a common piece of technology on farms?
And it really depends on how much support we can get and to push this technology forward and into a commercially available product so that we'll be able to benefit and our farmers in Australia.
So does it depends on whether the consumer is interested or not, but the technology is there.
The interest of the consumers is definitely there. And so according to our experiment, we see that more and more interest and from the fruit growers. And even today, we're going to have four more growers and to come to the farm to have a look at our demo. And on the other hand, the technology need to be and keep and developing. I would not say it is immediately available, and there are still some challenges we need to handle. But I would like to say that we can already achieve 80% of apples from the within the workspace of the robot. Mm.
And is this robot just designed for apples, or can it be used on other fruit?
This is a great question. And we currently develop for apple only, but this technology can be extended and to other fruits, and such like pear, citrus, and stone fruits, etc.
Mm. And can we talk about price point? Do you know how much one of these might cost a farmer?
Yes, I understand, and the price is very sensitive. So I would say that the current material cost is about 80,000. But with the advance of this technology, I believe this price can be dramatically reduced and within 3 years. So it will be really affordable to our farmers.
Dr. Chao Chen from Monash University speaking to Alex Treloar. Now, you're coming up soon to 5 minutes of the news, but to take you there, I do have a song. This is Thelma Plum with Father Said.
You're sailing past the wind, past the wind. My father said, now son, don't help me out. You're sailing past the wind, past the wind. My father said, now son, don't help me out. And now he's gone.
Thelma Plum with Father Said, and that's all for Pacific Beat this morning. Thank you so much for your company. Next, you have 5 minutes of news.